Hit it.
Welcome to the Test Talks Podcast, the place to go to geek out on software testing. And now your host, whose mission is to help you succeed with test automation, Joe Colantonio.
Hey, it's Joe, and welcome to another episode of Test Talks. I just finished up my first ever online conference dedicated 100% to creating automation awesomeness, Automation Guild. It was awesome. It totally exceeded my expectations. Not only were the speakers incredible, but the community that has grown up around the conference was unbelievable. Everyone was participating in the chat. We created a Slack channel, and everyone's helping one another, so it was a really great event. We had 750 attendees from over 46 countries, so it really was a blast. And I'm definitely going to put it on next year. So if you missed Automation Guild, it's actually not too late. The beauty of it is it's all online. So what I did is I pre-recorded all the sessions from the speakers. But not only that, I also recorded all the live sessions that went on last week. So even if you weren't able to attend live, you could still benefit from all the pre-recorded videos and also the live chats that I had with all the speakers that I also recorded. So you do miss out on one of the best benefits of Automation Guild, and that's the ability to ask questions live during the conference itself. But if you missed out for any reason, I think this information is so valuable and so needed within the community. I'm going to keep registration open so that if you wanted to get all those pre-recorded videos, you get all the pre-recorded video sessions from the speakers and all the recordings from the live sessions. And if that sounds good to you, I would highly recommend you check out Automation Guild at automationguild.com and purchase yourself a ticket and register. And just you could jump right in and be able to watch all the videos right now. The live element will not be there, but like I said, all that information has been captured and stored in video for you. Now on with our episode. Based on some of the conversations we had during the Automation Guild last week, one of the biggest challenges I see many automation engineers working on in 2017 is DevOps and how to treat not only automation tests as code, but also infrastructure like code. So a few of those techniques like Jenkins, Docker, and Vagrant are critical technologies that you should know in order to excel this year in your career. In this episode, we'll be speaking to Wes Higby, author of multiple Pluralsight courses like Getting Started with Jenkins 2, Docker on Windows, and Intro to Vagrant. So if you want to expand your automation efforts beyond just functional tests in 2017, you don't want to miss this episode. Check it out. Test Talks is sponsored by the fantastic folks at Sauce Labs, the cloud-based automated testing platform that eliminates the need to maintain your own Selenium grid and test infrastructure. Try it for free today. Visit testtalks.com and click on the Sign Up Now link under the homepage sponsor section. Hey, Wes. Welcome to Test Talks.
Hey, thanks for having me, Joe. Glad to be here.
Awesome. It's great to have you on the show. You have a ton of Pluralsight courses I've really been binge watching the past few weeks. And a few of them I'd like to talk about today are Jenkins, Vagrant, and Docker. You have courses on all three. I'm not sure how much we'll get into all three, but I'd like to see how it goes. But before we get into it, can you just tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Yeah, I'm a consultant. I work with companies to help them overcome challenges that they're facing with technology projects. And that's me. And I basically do whatever is interesting, whatever comes across my desk that looks exciting.
Very cool. So why did you choose, let's start with Jenkins and then we'll go into Docker and Vagrant because I think that's the most interesting of the topics. At a high level, for people that don't know, what is Jenkins?
More or less, it's just a tool that helps you automate things and primarily build processes is the focus of Jenkins and a lot of similar tools like Team City. Just to get some automation around when you check something in, you can make sure that your application still compiles, for example, make sure that your unit tests still run, maybe make sure that you do some static analysis of your code base and find problems, catch things earlier rather than later, give you some confidence. And then a lot of people also will take it further and automate the delivery of software maybe into a testing environment to begin with so that they have a demo environment set up, maybe for some more end-to-end testing at that point. And then finally, some people will actually automate all the way through to a production environment. So you check in code and it flows all the way into production if everything works out.
Very cool. Now, I don't know if I misunderstood in the course. You mentioned something that a lot of people use Jenkins just for continuous integration. They don't realize they can use it to automate things that they do every day in the development process. So a few of those, I think you just brought up, like unit testing. What other types of things? Give us some other examples.
Yeah, I use Jenkins in some of my own server environments, and I use it, for example, to run backups. So just to backup volumes for Docker containers, for example, I'll spin up a Docker container just to run a backup, more or less, of one of my websites, for example. So it can be used for quite a few things beyond just even, I guess, building software, even though that's the primary focus that people come to the tools with.
Awesome. Yes, I just noticed after watching it, I didn't realize you can run a remote agent and have Jenkins connect to it. So I'm using it almost as a runner for my Selenium test as a coordinator. So it's kind of cool. You can actually orchestrate test runs in it like that.
Yeah, pretty much anything. And I tell people this when they ask me, can we do this or can we do that? When, you know, again, this is not just Jenkins, but TeamCity and other tools. People, can I do this? Can I do that? And my answer is always, if you can do it from the command line, you can do it inside of any of these tools. So you can automate just about anything so long as you can automate it from the command line.
Awesome. Now, the name of your course is, I believe it was Learning Jenkins 2. So I believe that the main change in Jenkins 2 was the addition of pipeline. And you said before you really didn't like Jenkins. And now with the pipeline feature, you like it more. So could you just tell us a bit more what that pipeline feature is?
Yeah, so it's just basically instead of having individual jobs or builds and needing to kind of stitch those together with dependencies in the old model, that was very painful. So if you wanted to break something up beyond just a simple build process, you could think of a build process as a cron job, more or less. And you might think of having cron jobs that do different things. Like one cron job might compile your application and run some unit tests and package it up. And that's kind of like what people think of with continuous integration, doing that every time someone checks in to get feedback. So that might be one cron job. But then the output of that is some artifact, like maybe a NuGet package or any package, RubyGem, for example. And you might want to take that then and you might want to deploy it somewhere for testing purposes. So that might be a separate cron job then to deploy into QA. It might be a separate cron job to deploy into a production environment. And you have all these different cron jobs, more or less, and you had to stitch them together with dependencies. And it was very brittle and very difficult to set up in the past. Now with the new pipeline model, you're more or less writing a script and you kind of just delineate different parts of the script where you want to have a separate stage, more or less, in your pipeline. And you can compose together some rather complicated processes, if you will, all from a single job instead of needing to break it up in a bunch of small pieces. That's kind of one of the reasons. I think the other reason I wasn't too keen on Jenkins pre-V2 was because a lot of plugins out of the box just weren't there for you. If I remember right, you still had to install a Git plugin, for example, and then you needed four or five other plugins to even work effectively with Git. And you had to make sure that you got all the right things. You had to know about all these things. And if you didn't, you wouldn't have known that you could even have these things. And then you had to install all these plugins and get them working together and make sure that they work together. And if anything broke, you're on the hook to fix it. Whereas in the V2 model, there's a lot of good suggested plugins out of the box now that cover a lot of these common use cases. And that means there's a lot more emphasis on making sure that these work and people don't have to know how to go find these plugins. They're there to begin with.
So that's interesting. And the reason why it's interesting to me is I work for a large company and they chose Electric Flow. And I asked them, why did you choose Electric Flow? Just for the standpoint of being able to find information, I can never find it for Electric Flow. And they told me the reason why is when they tried Jenkins that the plugins were kind of janky. They didn't work well. And so that's interesting you brought that up. In the newer version, you haven't seen that as much.
No, because if you've seen this in the new version, it's a really nice workflow. When you start up a new instance of Jenkins, it'll ask you what plugins would you like. And there's like a default set that just makes sense. And there are things like Git that, you know, I don't know why anybody today wouldn't have installed. So a beginner can come to this tool now and not need to know that they need four or five plugins just to get code checked out of a Git repository. It just makes you more productive at the end of the day. And also, I think, like I said, that emphasis on supporting those plugins, and because they're out of the box, it means that it's a higher quality product at the end of the day.
Awesome. So I like to switch gears really quick. So Jenkins, talking about Jenkins, they have a lot of plugins, and some of the plugins that it has plugins for Vagrant and Docker. So so if people want to learn more about Jenkins, they should definitely check out your Getting Started with Jenkins 2 course on Pluralsight. Mm-hmm. But an older one that you have that I notice is, I will edit this out, Introduction to Versioning Environments with Vagrant. And I guess the biggest thing I've been dealing with lately is which one, if someone's getting started, maybe they're totally different. I think people, let me rephrase this. I think people sometimes get confused between Vagrant and Docker. Are they the same thing? And if not, you know, what's Vagrant compared to Docker? What are the differences between the two?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought this up. This is a favorite topic of mine. They're not the same thing, though. I've been thinking a lot about Docker lately and how to explain it to people. And if you understand Vagrant, you'll understand Docker. It's just more or less automating something else. So Vagrant, the whole idea is to simplify working with VMs. In the past, I don't know if you've worked with them where, you know, you create a VM, you stick an ISO in a CD drive, a virtual CD drive, and you boot up and you go through an installer, whether that's Windows or Ubuntu or whatever it is. And it's a painful process just to get a VM up and running. It can take half an hour if you know what you're doing. It can take hours or days if you don't. So Vagrant, the idea is with a simple command, more or less, Vagrant init and then Vagrant up, two commands, I guess, you can have a VM up and running on your machine. And how it facilitates that is there's already a pre-built VM image that gets pulled down in what's known as a box off of Vagrant Cloud, or it could come from somewhere else as well, but Vagrant Cloud is kind of like a Docker Hub, if you know what Docker Hub is. And you just basically pull these existing images. It might have Ubuntu on them or CentOS or some VM image that has whatever operating system or distribution you want, and pulls down, and it creates a new VM with it. And the VM is usually up and running within a few minutes at most if it's a Linux VM. If it's Windows, it usually takes a little bit longer, but either way, it's fast. And you have commands to stop that VM, start it back up. You can control the configuration of the VM from a Vagrant file, which is just a Ruby file. Just gives you a little programmatic configuration language to say, hey, I want there to be two CPUs on this VM, or I want there to be 4 gigabytes of memory, or I want there to be bridge network set up so that I can get out to the internet or whatever it might be. I might be able to access this remotely. You can configure networking. You can plug scripts in so that when that VM starts up, you can install some software. Like if you wanted to have a VM with Nginx on it, you could have a script that installs Nginx once that VM is up and running, and that's a provisioner. You more or less just automate all these different pieces around creating a VM, and you put all your configuration for that into a Vagrant file, and then you have a series of commands to bring VMs up and down very easily. And not just one VM, but you can have many. In that course that you're talking about toward the end, I show how you can spin up 3 VMs to have a MongoDB replica set up and running within minutes, which is just crazy because it's very hard to do without having a lot of infrastructure in place already. But I show how you can do it in a matter of minutes with Vagrant, and that's why that's so powerful. But and then you said to contrast that to Docker. So Docker is not the same thing, and we can get into that. But basically, you can think of, instead of VMs, Docker takes care of what's known as a container. It's a different way to run a process. And we can get into that in a minute if we want.
Awesome. Yeah, I'd like to dive in and a little bit more. But first, I just want to touch on a few things with Vagrant before we explore
that. Let's cover Vagrant first.
So I guess the biggest advantage I've seen of Vagrant, and I'm very new to it, is the Vagrant file that you mentioned. And the reason why is you can check that into version control. And in theory, I assume, I have eight to 10 sprint teams I work with. And they're always complaining. Each of them have their own environments. But when we go into what we call our CI environment, tests don't always run the same way. And it's because the environment's different. The machines are different. And so I was thinking, hey, if I have a Vagrant file, I could check that into version control. And then any team could spin up that VM, and it should, in theory, be exactly like the machine I'm testing in my CI environment. Am I understanding that correctly?
Absolutely. So a great example of this, recently I was playing with Rocket, which is an alternative Docker, as far as the runtime for a container. And I wanted to have a VM up and running to be able to play with it. And if you go out to the CoreOS repo for Rocket out on GitHub, so github.com/coreos/RKT, you'll see right at the root of that repo is a Vagrant file. All I have to do is clone this repo or copy this file, really, and I can run a Vagrant up on this file. And I have a VM up and running, and they have installers in here to install Rocket. And I, more or less after a few minutes, have this VM up and running, and I can play around with Rocket, which is a tool that I want to learn about. So within minutes, I have environment ready to go. I can get to learning instead of worrying about how to install the software. Someone else has already taken care of that for me. And then the nice thing is, once I'm ready, if I want to learn more about how the install works, well, there's a nice install-rkt shell script that I can go look at that's a part of that Vagrant file that will teach me a little bit more about what's going on behind the scenes.
Awesome. Yeah. And I guess another feature I think I really enjoy is, and maybe I'm not understanding correctly, is, like you said, you can create a baseline. So you can go out to, I forgot the name of the website, HashiCorp, and search for boxes like Linux boxes or Red Hat. And you can just create...
If you look for Vagrant Cloud,
yep.
That's what it used to be, vagrantcloud.com. That's been redirected to Atlas. It's just a part of Atlas now, which is HashiCorp's enterprise offering that layers on top of a bunch of their tools like Vagrant and otherwise. There's a search page out there to search for boxes, and you can say, I want this box to work with VirtualBox. And I guess that's another dimension I didn't mention. So Vagrant is obviously has to work with some hypervisor, and it works with a variety of different hypervisors, VirtualBox, VMware, Parallels, you name it, it pretty much works with it. And you can go look for boxes for your provider and then pull that down and have Ubuntu up and running, for example. In fact, Ubuntu has official images out here on Vagrant Cloud. Several different distributions, CentOS also, have official images out here that are being built by basically the people behind the project, so you know it's a good starting point.
Cool. So I guess I have a user case that's not very common, and that is my company has a specific flavor of Red Hat that they use to install a database on, this really legacy database. So if a box does not exist already, can you create your own box, or can you create a Vagrant VM based on an existing template that's in like VMware? Is that possible?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a bunch of different ways you can slice and dice this. If you already have a VM somewhere that's up and running, you can get that extracted and you can make your own box from that. So yeah, if you already have a VM, you could basically take a picture of that and build your own box from that. The other route you can go, there's a tool called Packer. This is a tool also by HashiCorp that helps you build these boxes, that helps you build VM images in general. It's not just necessarily for Vagrant, but you can create a Vagrant box. You can also spit out just a VHD if you wanted to, or whatever file type you are working with for whatever provider. Packer just basically automates creating VM images, and Vagrant boxes are obviously one output, I guess, if you think of it that way. It's kind of one of the formats you can save to. So that can automate the entire process for you. So you have your custom flavor that's built on you probably take some RHEL ISO and you boot up a VM and install some software, right? And then spit out something, I imagine.
Yep.
And then so you could just take all the scripts that you use to do that, plug that into a Packer build process, and then have Packer spit out the image for you. And then you could have it spit out a Vagrant box as well with that image inside of it. And then you could be using it with Vagrant. And really neat. The neat thing you can do is, we talked about Jenkins, so you could actually have your scripts to do that checked into a repo, and you could have a Jenkins job that triggers every time somebody checks in a change to build a new Vagrant box for you and push it out to maybe Vagrant Cloud, or push it out to your own private repository of images. And then you just automatically have this box that's rebuilt for you.
Awesome. Yeah, I really love this concept. And I think you mentioned this, it's almost, we're moving towards treating our infrastructure as code also, and this really allows us to do that.
Yep. And I will say that course is a bit dated. Yep. Toward the end of the course, a lot of things have changed in the examples I gave. So if people are going to follow along with that course, definitely do the beginning of the course. But if you start to run into trouble with some of the more complex examples toward the end, they don't have to be done. You can skip that stuff. You'll get what you need out of the beginning of the course. And yeah, that's just something I wanted to throw out there, because I have a lot of examples out there of some software that has changed quite drastically. So they don't exactly work so easily unless you go pull old versions of software.
Awesome. And I guess before we move on to Docker, I just want to make one other point too, I think. And that is, I think you mentioned that when you have a vagrant file, these machines come up very quickly. So someone may say, well, I already have a VM template. Why do I care about Vagrant? Well, in my experience, what I like to do is I have 8 sprint teams and I want to run them at the same time. In theory, I could spin up their own environment for each of those test cases and have really clean test runs because I can just spin these up really quickly, where if I was doing that from a VM template, it would be almost impossible.
Yeah, so I can do this right now. Vagrant init, and I can say box cutter, which is an image, is an organization out on Vagrant Cloud that has some good images or boxes available. I can say Ubuntu 16.04. I can run that init, and the init is just creating a Vagrant file. That's all it's doing. You can create these Vagrant files by hand as well. The init just gives you a sample one, more or less. Then I can run Vagrant up right afterwards. And let's just see. I already have the box locally, so I don't have to download it. It'll take a little time if you have a slow internet connection to download the box, because it's obviously large, several hundred megs up to several gigs, just depending on the distribution. Yeah, it's already starting up right now. And I'll just tell you when it's done here as we keep going. I'm sure it's only going to be a minute or two for this to be up and running. And in this case, I'm using this with VMware Fusion on my Mac, so I can boot an image in VMware. And yeah, it's already inserting the key. The machine is booted up. SSH is already available. And it's done. I can then type Vagrant SSH. And I have a shell opened up inside of that VM, and I can now run whatever I'd like to run inside of that VM.
So that's incredible. That is awesome.
Yeah. I'm serious. That was from scratch. So it's, a lot of them are really fast. So I want to learn so many things these days, like Rocket, for example, but I have a Mac here. How am I going to install Rocket? Like, I can't run that obviously on a Mac. It's Linux software. So, you know, I have a lot of Linux VMs that I like to boot up rather quickly, play around with them for an afternoon, and then I want to shut them down. I want to free up those resources on my machine, and I want to go about my day not having a bunch of stuff running on my computer that I was playing with. VMs are a great way to do that, because obviously once you shut them down, everything's shut down. You don't have to worry about, did I leave this process on? Do I have some application still open? All of it's gone once you shut that VM down, and you can do a Vagrant destroy, and in a matter of seconds, the VM is just blown away as well. And this is just not something you're going to do with any other command line tooling, except maybe things like VBox Manage with VirtualBox would give you some similar productivity, but you don't have a Vagrant file with that approach. And what you're doing there is specific to VirtualBox, so it doesn't work when you want to move over to VMware. And a great example of that is I like VirtualBox most of the time, but lately I've been wanting to play around with nested virtualization, and that is not going to work with VirtualBox. So I need to have VMware Fusion to be able to have that ability to share virtualization, nest virtualization inside of my VM. So all I did was switch my provider from VirtualBox to VMware, and it just so happened the box I'm working with is built for both. And I'm up and running with VMware instead, and I can now check that box more or less to turn the setting on for nested virtualization, and I can do that from the Vagrant file. And I'm up and running, and I don't have to worry about knowing a whole different set of tools just because I want to take advantage of VMware's nested virtualization.
Awesome. I guess another use case, I want to get to Docker, is that for me, I do a lot of test automation, so I have a framework set up that has a certain IDE, has certain tools installed. And a lot of times people like, I can't get it started and I have to go in and try to help troubleshoot their issue, where I could just have a Vagrant file that has everything I need and say, just start this up and you should be good to go. So another good time saver.
Yes. Very, 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 very valuable. There are some edge cases where you'll run into trouble if you're trying to develop inside of a VM, but they're no different than what you would have had in the past if you're trying to develop inside of a VM. So in some of the advanced cases, when you're trying to maybe run a web server inside of a VM, there's going to be a few hiccups. But the nice thing is once you figure those out, you put them in a Vagrant file in a script, and they're taken care of for everybody then. And you have a central place to go to know what oddities there are. And you've got a version history of those oddities when you're working with VMs.
That's such a big point. And the reason why I say, once again, work for a large team, not every team knows how to set up a certain server. Like one team might know a little bit, another team might know another. But like you said, if everyone contributes to this Vagrant file, you no longer have this tribe knowledge. It's documented, it's in version control, and anyone could spin it up. So it's beautiful.
One place to go to figure out what exactly, why things are the way they are.
Absolutely. All right. So I'd like to get into Docker now. So
yeah.
I think most people understand VMs. So what's the difference between an image, and do you ever use both at the same time in a developing workflow?
Yeah. So first off, I could just say, as far as Vagrant goes, Vagrant has a provider for Docker, which basically just means it's taking care of getting Docker set up and installed on a VM for you. Because you need that different environment a lot of times to be able to run the Docker engine, since it's it's not going to work on my Mac, for example. Mac doesn't have any concept of a container. A BSD doesn't have a concept, or at least not that I've played around with. It would work with Docker. So let's step back and talk, though, about Docker and what it is before I get into too many specifics and confuse people.
Sure.
One of the first things I like to say is, let's put that VM comparison aside for a second. I see a lot of people, when they try and explain Docker, they try and explain it compared to a VM. And I think that's counterproductive and it's confusing to people that are new to Docker. Let's talk about how containers actually work briefly, and then we can go back to the VM and Vagrant discussion and see how they're related.
Perfect.
So a container in the Linux world, and the notion of a container is something that's been worked on for a long time now. Docker popularized containers. It did not create containers. And Docker is not containers. Docker, the engine, is just a means, a container runtime, more or less. It'll take care of creating containers for you, starting and stopping them. But what is a container? A container is just a process. That's really the best way to look at it. So when we run software on our computer, it runs in a process. And that's a boundary around that piece of software. When you have an executable that you want to execute, it literally gets loaded into memory, and there's its own process associated with it. And then code out of that executable in memory is pulled into the processor to run whenever that processor gets a slice of the CPU to run. So each program you load, even like Microsoft Word or Chrome or Firefox or a terminal, each program that you run has a process, or maybe multiple processes that are executing on your machine. And in the past, those processes really have not been isolated from each other at all. So when you have a computer, you know, these, you can pull up the activity monitor on your computer and see a whole list of processes, everything that's running on your machine, unless maybe you don't have admin rights and you can only see a subset then. But most of the time, you can see everything running on a machine. And that's because we really have no isolation other than the process itself. So a process is kind of a boundary so you can do context switching between different processes that are executing on the computer. But beyond that, you know, they can talk to each other, they can see each other, they can share each other's resources. Everything is shared. It's kind of like a small business. When a small business starts up, employees share an office, they can get access to everything they want. The employees are kind of like processes, and the resources, like the phones and the filing cabinets and printers, they're all available to everybody. There's no isolation. When we talk about containers, all we're talking about is adding some more isolation around a process, kind of like building up some walls. In many ways, it's like when you move from a small business into a big business and teams are created, or divisions sometimes are created, and you have resources dedicated to each division. So one division has its own office, for example. It has its own filing cabinets in that office. It has its own phone system. It has its own printers and other resources. And oftentimes, employees between divisions or departments can't access those resources outside of their department. That's really what we're talking about with processes now. We're putting up these boundaries around processes so that they can't share things like the file system anymore, so that they can't share networking stacks anymore. And what really happens is we have, and I'll talk a little bit about from the Linux perspective, we have what's called a namespace in Linux. And really all it is just this notion of, I like to think of it as like a list of names. So namespace, think list of names or list of something. So we have what's known as a mount namespace in Linux, and this is a list of mount points. A list of mount points produces a file system. So when two processes get their own list of mount points, that means they each can have their own file systems, which means that processes don't have to share files anymore. So that's one of the levels of isolation that containers bring to the picture. We also layer in a whole bunch of other types of isolation. For example, network namespaces in the Linux world, which means that each application potentially can have its own networking stack, which, long story short, it means each application can have its own IP address, is really what it boils down to. So you can continue to layer all these types of isolation onto a process to the point where the isolation, to the point where the process believes it's on a completely separate computer. For example, another namespace in Linux is called a UTS namespace, and it basically makes it so that each process can have its own host name. So it's like a machine name, the computer name. It's like a name tag. So it's like each process can physically have a different machine name. So when you add all these in, all of a sudden it looks like two processes are running on separate computers, even though they're not. They're running on the same machine. And if you were to open up Activity Monitor from the context of one of those processes, you wouldn't see the other processes there. You would just see the processes related to you. So we're creating groups of really isolated processes. That's it. So when you hear the word container, just think even more isolation than we've had in the past. And I say even more because if you understand virtual memory, how virtual memory works, virtual memory is more or less a namespace. It gives each process its own virtual memory address space so that it can pretend as if there's no other processes using that memory, even though behind the scenes, the operating system and the CPU are taking care of swapping out pages of memory into the physical memory from that virtual address space. It's the same idea. We're adding more isolation, not just memory isolation. We're isolating pretty much all the resources on a computer now to the point where it looks like processes run in separate machines.
Cool. So why is this isolation important? Does it help you debug things better when you're developing software? Or
yeah, so if we go back to why do we have all this? Why are we running processes in new ones? Why do we need this isolation? Well, we know that like managing software is a pain. And I have a Windows Docker course that just came out. I would encourage people to take a look at this because I get into a lot of depth. But more or less, managing software is a pain. Finding the software to install, usually we have to go to these random one-off websites to find software from the vendor that makes it. We have to download it through their proprietary means. We have a proprietary installer. Maybe we have package managers, but they don't work across operating systems. That's on the side of installing the software. Then we have to configure the software. But then when we're running the software, we can have port conflicts. We can have problems with shared libraries. We can have all sorts of resource conflicts of processes fighting over resources on the computer. And we know that this causes a lot of grief. For example, you know, the big reason that updating an operating system is such a pain is because usually in updating the operating system, you update some of these shared libraries and potentially break applications that depend on the nuance of an old version. So we can't update our operating systems, which is why we have security vulnerabilities, because we've got these old OSs running so that we don't break the processes that are running on top of them. So now if we have more isolation to the point where each process can have its own file system, well, then I can update the operating system's file system without affecting any of the file systems of any of these processes. And they'll keep running while the operating system gets its security patches. And then when the time is right, I might need to update an application. That means I update the file system just for it, and it doesn't break any other file systems on the computer for other processes. It's kind of the same reason why do we move an application to a separate VM? And this gets back to the VM side of things. Once you have all this isolation, you effectively have a separate machine without needing the overhead of a VM. So that's when it makes sense to come back to this VM analogy, because once you add all this isolation in, it's kind of like having a different means of having a virtualized environment. It's by virtue of isolation, though, not really by virtue of having virtual resources per se. It's more isolation.
Cool. I guess I was thinking a lot of times I've been hearing more and more about microservices, and people were saying what's great about microservices, if you run it in a Docker container, that it really becomes so thinly sliced that when something breaks, you know what breaks. So when you're actually fixing something, you're just fixing that one thing. So you're not going to impact anything else. And that's where isolation really helps.
Yeah. So great. I mean, just a great way to think about this is even with tools like Chef and Puppet and Ansible that help us automate configuring a machine and installing all the software and putting the config files and everything, that is still a major pain, even once you've automated all of it. Now, what we're really doing is we're saying, we're going to have each application more or less run on its own machine, though this is all taken care of for us transparently by the operating system. We get all the same benefits, though. So it means each app will have its own file system. So when we are configuring and installing that app, we don't have to worry about 30 other config files on that machine that we're updating as well. We don't have to worry about installing MySQL database onto the same machine as our Nginx web server. So we can focus on that one piece of software that we're installing into this file system for that piece of software, and we don't have to have anything else there. It just really simplifies things to the point where we can get back to shell scripts in a lot of cases just to set things up. And you'll see that when you're looking at Docker files, which is a means of building the file system, more or less, for a container. You will see people more or less just running simple bash scripts to get things set up, just simple app git calls to install some packages into the file system. And then that's all you have to do. It's really simple.
Awesome. So Wes, in the pre-show, you mentioned something that images are more important than containers. So I guess the question is, why are images more important than containers?
So after we understand that containers are just processes that have basically their own file system, then we have to have somewhere for that file system to come from, right? we just can't snap our fingers and have a separate file system on a computer. We have to pull that from somewhere. And file systems are difficult to set up, and they're large, so they're difficult to distribute as well. So the piece that everybody misses when we're talking about containers aren't that interesting. It's just a different way of running a process. It's just actually a few flags that you pass when you're creating a process in the operating system. What's really interesting is how we configure the isolation, because if you think about booting up a machine, you have an init system that takes care of configuring networking, mounting all the file systems and everything. We have to replicate all of that. And that's where most of that comes from, an image, which has the file system itself for your application. And so if we didn't have that, we would still have to build those images by hand. And that's very complicated for especially a beginner to do. It's kind of like when you get back to Jenkins and I said there weren't plugins out of the box. Well, if we didn't have a means to distribute the file system for these containers, it wouldn't be very helpful to people if they had to create that all by themselves. And so I don't think Docker definitely wouldn't have blown up without Docker Hub and the image technology behind Docker to be able to easily pull down a file system, is what we're talking about, that somebody else built that we can trust. Somewhat. I'm not saying everything is trustable on Docker Hub, but to have all those things there, and also to have a choice of file systems out on Docker Hub for all the different applications that we might want to run, so that we don't have to build these all by ourselves. Someone else has already built it. We get to rely on and build on top of the work of somebody else. It'd be kind of like having it's kind of like you mentioned earlier, could I take an existing Vagrant box or Vagrant VM image, and can I build on top of it? That's what we're really talking about here. Can I take somebody else's image and can I add on top what I need, if I need anything, or can I just run theirs if that's all I need? And the answer is yes when it comes to Docker Hub and the image technology behind Docker. You don't have to know how to do anything to create these file systems to be able to use them. They're just there for you. And even more proof that this is the reason that Docker blew up is that LXC existed for a long time before Docker, creating containers. But if you look at LXC's history, it never had a really good means of distributing images up until recently. And so that's what I believe held back adoption, because, you know, building these images is not trivial. Even if you have scripts to do it, which were provided by LXC, it's still something that can go wrong. It's still something you have to wait for it to happen, and it takes a lot of time. The reason that Docker blew up is because it basically took out that hard part of the equation for people.
All right, Wes, before we go, this episode is going to be released one of the first weeks of 2017. So what do you see as the future for both VMs and containers? And let us know the best way to find or contact you.
People can reach out at weshigby.com or fullcitytechnology.com. The future of... and my email's on both of those. You can find them somewhere in there. The future of VM and containers. The future of VMs is actually here. And I just realized this the other day. I wasn't thinking about it very much. But Microsoft, when they released Windows containers recently, built a second type of basically container runtime. And it's a Hyper-V container. So instead of just this process isolation that I talked about, so you could think of one type of container as just being process isolation, Microsoft also has a second type that's a really optimized Hyper-V VM. So you actually get the benefits of a VM with all the benefits of Docker, which are go back to the image. So more or less, when you plug in Hyper-V containers into Docker, you now have an automated means of pulling a file system for a VM, is really what it boils down to. and having a process up and running in a VM in a matter of seconds. And it is just impressive. And I thought that this was Windows only. I thought it was mostly experimental on the Linux side of things. But the reason I'm spending some time with Rocket is because they actually have the equivalent thing for Linux containers. Intel experimented with what's called had a project called Clear Containers. And I thought it was just experimental only, but I actually built this into Rocket, which is a container runtime, so that you can actually create Linux containers inside of a highly optimized VM in your Linux environment. And you can go take a look at this. It uses KVM behind the scenes. And I mean, just one flag difference, you can have your process like Nginx. Instead of having it running in an isolated environment on your current machine, you can actually have a separate VM up and running in seconds. It is so mind-boggling how fast this is. So the future of VMs is here, and it's going to continue to evolve, I think. We are going to bring this good image technology to VMs as well. We already are. This image technology is so powerful to be able to have the file system pulled down, and also the image provides a runtime environment as well for configuring like what runs and the environment of what runs. I don't want to get into all that, but basically we're going to bring the same image goodness to VMs, and we are going to optimize the heck out of VMs to the point where it won't matter if you are using a VM or you're using a process with namespace isolation, for example. It will be just about as fast either way you go, and there won't be much more overhead to have a VM in terms of memory. So people will be able to just toggle this like a setting. And I think that the future of VMs is very bright as well, because they provide much more isolation even than this this process isolation model that we're talking about with containers.
Thank you, Wes, for your Jenkins, Vagrant, and Docker automation awesomeness. For links to everything of value we covered in this episode, head on over to testtalks.com/136. And while you're there, make sure to click on the Sign Up Now free button under the exclusive sponsor section to learn all about Sauce Labs awesome products and services. So that's it for this episode of Test Talks. I'm Joe, and my mission is to help you succeed with automation awesomeness. As always, test everything and keep the good. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the Test Talks podcast. Head on over to www.testtalks.com for full show notes, amazing blog articles, and other automation awesomeness.